call the Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance Meeting to order. We'll start with the roll call.
Johnson.
Here.
Palmer.
Here.
Hillstrom.
Yes.
Beckerfin.
Here.
Considine.
Here.
Dean.
Here.
Frankie.
Here.
Dossel.
Here.
Out. Lucero. Newberger. O'Neill. Pinto.
Here.
Uglin.
Here.
Ward.
Here.
Zerwas.
Here.
Okay, Representative Dean, have you had an opportunity to review the April 10th minutes?
I have, Mr. Chairman. I would move the minutes of April 10th.
Representative Dean has moved the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. We have a number of bills up today. We'll be starting out with House File 2879. And we lay this bill over for possible inclusion. Is Representative Anderson here? Good morning, Representative Anderson.
Good morning, Chair Johnson and members.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. This bill, I want to thank the committee last year for allowing some help for the city of Melrose. They had a devastating fire in their downtown district in September of 2016, and they're beginning the task of redevelopment, and they just need a bit of an extension in the exemptions granted by us last year. And with me, Mr. Chair, is the Melrose Administrator to talk about the bill and explain why they need the extension.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Well, good morning. My name is Michael Brethorst. I'm the city administrator for the city of Melrose. So, Chairman Johnson, and committee members, again, I just want to start off by saying we just need a little bit more time to make this become a reality. We have seen some significant progress in the past year since this appropriation has been given to us, as well as the sales tax exemption. Now, the city of Melrose, and we also have a developer in place right now that we have tentative terms for the development of this site, of the adjacent site. Now, with the fire, we lost 25% of our downtown. We also lost 36% of our housing stock in our downtown from this fire. So it just tells you in regards to the sheer impact of this community. But as of today, the state assistance has leveraged both public and private dollars for the renovation of two storefronts in our downtown. It's aided in the restorations of a building we refer to as the Ilias Building, and it's soon going to lead to the restoration of also additional storefronts that have secondary impacts from this fire. Now, the state's also helped us to clean up a site in preparation for potential redevelopment, and it's soon going to be shovel-ready. We're also pushing forward with the public utilities improvements that will hopefully be awarded here on Thursday night at the City Council meeting. But just to, in short, though, I am very pleased with the support that we've gotten from the Department of Public Safety and their efforts to help us through this process to administer these funds. Specifically, we want to thank Wayne Lamoureux, Bill Hurt, John Moore, as well as Director Kelly, and their help to make this a very unique situation, help to administer this process. There's just too many people to thank in regards to this, and I regret that I can't hit everybody. But in short, we just need more time. And like I do have pictures of the proposed development for the site. It's absolutely spectacular for what we can potentially see rebuilt after the fire. So I do thank you for the opportunity and be happy to share this with you as well.
Any questions from members? Any public testimony on this bill? Okay, I know the Department of Public Safety is in support of this, and I know how devastating it would be to lose 25% of your town and 36% of your housing stock. I want to thank you for coming here. And any last remarks, Representative Anderson?
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. And the original bill calls for a five-year extension. We don't feel we need the entire 5 years, so we'll be amending this to have a three-year extension when this bill goes to the tax committee.
Thank you. With that, will the bill be laid over? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So he just said that when this bill goes to the Tax Committee and we're laying it over, so is it your intention that the entire public safety bill go to the Tax Committee, or what is your intention?
There is a clone bill that's out there.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, we have House File 8375, Representative Kirsch Berlin. Representative Becker Finn, do you wish to move this bill?
Move this bill in for possible inclusion.
Thank you. I believe there is an A1 amendment as well.
I would move that amendment.
Thank you. All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion, the amendment is adopted. Representative Finish Berlin, if you want to present your bill.
Wonderful. Thank you, Chair and members, for having me here today to listen to this very important issue that I'm bringing before you. I am proposing a task force that will investigate the moral crisis of the missing and murdered Indigenous women in Minnesota. It's a devastating reality that our Native American women are going missing and murdered in some of the most violent ways. In some regions of Minnesota, Native women are murdered at more than 10 times the national average. And it's really unfathomable to me that while Native American women make up only 1% of Minnesota's population, they make up almost 25% of the total number of homicides related to domestic violence. And there are so many reasons. Most of them have very historic undertones to it, around the historic trauma that our Native American communities have experienced. And so I'm asking for this task force to do a number of things. The first thing it will do is develop appropriate methods for tracking and collecting the data. One of the worst situations is that there is a total lack of comprehensive data collection. There's not a system to record accurately the number of missing and murdered women in Indian Country. And so it will also create policies around policing, child welfare, coroner practices, as well as measures necessary to reduce and address the violence. We will be looking for recommendations from this task force to reduce and end violence against our Indian women and girls in Minnesota. And it will also act as a liaison to the Commissioner of Public Safety agencies and non-government organizations. And then finally, they will report what they find and look at the systematic causes behind the violence to our Indigenous women and girls, such as the historical, social, economic, and cultural patterns and underlines. And so today I would like to bring a few folks forward to tell their stories and what they know about it. In your packet, you have hopefully found letters of support from a number of our Indian communities, as well as the chief of police from Duluth. We have strong bipartisan support. We had 100% support in our first hearing, and I would ask you for your support as well.
Thank you. If you want to start with your testifiers.
Yes. I have four women that would like to testify: Lori Paul from Breaking Free, great-grandmother Mary Lyons, who is an Ojibwe elder, Willamette Hardy Morrison, and Misty Babineau.
If the testifiers can please come down. Because we are short on time today, we have a lot of stuff to go through. We're going to ask you to try to keep your testimony as brief as possible, 2 to 3 minutes, if possible. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lori Paul. I work for Breaking Free. We are a survivor-led organization that works with women who have been involved in sexual trafficking. I also am co-director of a ministry called Native Strong. I've spent a lot of time on reservations listening to the stories. stories of abuse, of rape, hearing about the aunties who say their niece is missing, grandmothers whose daughters have been found dead. I'm hearing those stories. Also, I learned while working at Breaking Free, statistically, the highest percentage of women that have been pulled into sex trafficking are indigenous women. I met a man who has run across the United States 4 times with the American Indian Movement, bringing awareness to Native issues, and I'm writing his story. And he told me that he taught his little sister how to fight. And when he told me that, I thought, why would you teach her violence? But as I continued to hear more stories, made more friends, the Facebook posts that come across my feed of a girl missing or a mother missing or a daughter missing, and I see that was his greatest way of showing love, was to teach her how to fight. She told me that their mother had been found beaten to death underneath the bridge when they were children. These are the stories I hear. When I go and I speak publicly, I always wear some sort of beaded medallion or something because I know the voices aren't being heard, the stories aren't being paid attention to, the news reports aren't going out. This medallion was given to me by a stranger woman. She heard where I had gone to pray. I was at the funeral of Dennis Banks when she gave it to me. She was the daughter of Dennis Banks. Dennis's own granddaughter had been murdered in 2015, taken from Leech Lake. He was one of the founders of the American Indian Movement. I'm thankful that you're listening today. They have been speaking, and it's time they be heard. Something needs to be done. This is epidemic. And our state has places of great concern, the Duluth Harbor and the shipping area, and there's much more. So thank you for listening. There's hope because you're hearing today. Thank you.
Thank you. Mary Lyon? Good morning. Please state your name for the record and you may proceed.
Nina Bissup. My name is great grandmother Mary Lyons. I wrote this down so I stay within my 2 minutes. I'd have you guys here all day. Good morning. My name is great grandmother Mary Lyons. I'm an Ojibwe enrollee of the Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota, currently residing south of the river. My story began in 1990 when my baby sister Catherine Louise Lyons James was murdered on New Year's Eve. Her attacker was found though. She left behind 3 beautiful boys, 1, 7, and 8. The baby was with her during the time of her death and she was stabbed multiple times where she was nearly unrecognizable. He climbed into her chest, into her cavity, and nearly drowned within her blood. And it took a fire department man to use the jaws of life, that grip, to break her ribs, to break them free. My interest here goes beyond my sister's life story, as I worked in foster care and adoption arena for special needs children for decades. Many of the children have stories such as my nephews, of whom are now my sons. Many of the children of these murdered women are shuffled around the social welfare systems and never find their foundation of belonging or ever get to really work on what happened to their parents. Many of the children carry anger to express their loneliness and have difficulties with attaching to healthy relationships. What I'm leading up to is this. We need this task force, there's no question. We need to no longer turn the other cheek because some might think this is a tribal thing or these incidents rest in other jurisdictions or worse, these become cases that rest on dusty shelves. When this happens, the children have no closure. The whys build up and the outcomes become very costly to the state, more money than you would even imagine. The cost of foster care and adoption is expensive, and we don't have enough trained people to care for these children. The reason I support this task force is for the children that need closure, for the families that need closure, for the communities that need closure. This task force will bring awareness to an epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women, transgender, and the LGBT communities. This task force will bring attention to the predators that we will find you. We will. We'll find you. And the world will let the world know, especially here in Minnesota, that they do care about their Indigenous victims. Let us be the leaders. In closing, my son should be calling my little sister mom, not me. The many children out there should be calling their biological mom, mom, and not the many foster care parents or adoptive parents, if they're lucky. This task force could and will bring light to prevention and closures. The financial part of this is nothing to the millions of dollars this state here in Minnesota, puts out in out-of-home placements. Let's turn this around and be a player of positive in making this happen. Because just what was happening to here next week, I'm going to be reading this at the UN, and hopefully I'll have something positive to say what Minnesota is doing for missing and murdered Indigenous women. Jamie Griggs, thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and please proceed.
My name is Williamette Hardy Morrison. I'm from Colima, Minnesota. That's located on the Red Lake Indian Reservation. My daughter went missing in 1996, and we were denied the opportunity to file a missing persons report, and I know it's because we were Native. Sorry to make that point, but after we had to shuffle around and try to locate her ourselves, we finally found a criminal investigator from our reservation, and she put out a hit or look for my daughter, and she found her and she called us missing persons. They had her buried in a potter's grave in Illinois, and when we went to recover my daughter's body, we were told that we couldn't exhume her body and bring her home for proper burial, but we continued to pursue it, and we took it through the legal system. And when we, in the end all, we found that she did go into the medical examiners with her identification on her, and which had my Minneapolis address on it, and I was never notified by the medical examiner's office. They turned her into a white female, gave her a different name, and changed her date of birth on her death certificate. The end of my daughter's trail was August 6, 1996, a DUI. I don't believe my daughter ever made it to jail alive. And we never found any justice in our case yet, although we were able to take it before the judge in Illinois and have the cemetery order to exhume her body and have her returned back to me, which was in 2008. So we're able to bring her home and give her proper burial December 28th, 2008. And she went missing August 6th, 1996. I really think that this is important because as the mother of a missing Indigenous female, not even the media cares or returns a phone call. I have the list of all the media names and contact persons phone numbers that never returned my call back to this day. So that's another tragedy in our society here. We deserve to put our missing people out there on posters too. We deserve the opportunity to file a missing persons report when our daughters are missing, our kids are missing, regardless of what race we are. You're here on our homeland. You are here as guests. We received you and welcomed you here. Please honor our respect in return. You give us this respect that we in turn have earned. We've done a lot for everybody, from regardless of what country you came from. Please work with us because we are human beings as well. That's all I ask of the state of Minnesota at this time. Please deal with us. We're here. We will always be here welcoming many more of you from all your home countries. That is a tradition that our people has in this whole world. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for coming. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hello, my name is Mr. Gavin. I am a resident of the city of St. Paul. I am also a member of the Red Lake Nation. I'm going to share some of the story that I haven't shared before. The woman who gave birth to me disappeared almost 2 years ago. Not 4 years of the foster care system. I had my virginity taken at the age of 9. When I asked him why he did that to me, he said, because I'm a family leader and nobody's going to care. The summer between 6th and 7th grade, I was adopted by a beautiful woman who lives in his home. The following summer, we went up to Cal State to go visit with our family. My grandmother was murdered in front of me. Her attacker then came after me and my mother. I have a scar on my hands to date from where I grabbed my knife and tried to stab it and then plunged into my chest. Years down the road, I was 20 years old. I was kidnapped when I came to Minnesota. I was held. I was beaten. I was raped. I was brought all the way down here to St. Paul, where I fought for my freedom and I escaped. I know there are good police officers. I know this because I have encountered them. But on that day, when I fled down the squad car on my street to ask for help, he didn't believe me. My story is not there. Many of my sisters, many of my relations go through this. This matter needs to be addressed. And oftentimes when we do speak up, we are not heard. We are dehumanized, we are denied. So thank you for hearing this, and I urge you to please support this. Our community deserves healing. I deserve healing. All the mothers, the aunties, the uncles, the grandparents of these women who are gone and are never seen again, we deserve something too. Thank you.
Do you have any more testifiers?
We do have one more that would like to step up.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, good morning. My name is Angelica Perez, and I am the Public Policy Program Manager for the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. And we're here today, or I am here today, to voice our support for this task force and for the creation of it. The Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women represents 90 member programs that serve Minnesotans experiencing domestic violence. Every year, we release the Femicide Report, which documents Minnesotans who lost their lives due to domestic violence. In the years of 2013 to 2016, we identified 7 Native victims: Sonia Ann Smith, Krista Fisherman, Lisa Isham, Elizabeth Gregg, Eugenia Tallman, Rose Downwin, and Tanya Spinaway. But we know that this is not a complete account of the people we have lost. In compiling the Femicide Report to get an idea of who they are as people, we rely on criminal records, receive information from media sources, social media, friends, and family. And for the past 3 years, we've been able to gather race data on cases included in our report, although we know that some of this data is incomplete and it's not wholly reliable, which points to the importance of a task force like this. And although some of this information is missing, we are still able to draw some conclusions, one of which is that domestic violence homicides have a disproportionate impact on Native communities. The Task Force on Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women would provide us all with important data on what happens to Native women, Two-Spirit people, and the Native community. We need this data so that, along with our Native colleagues, we can work to end this epidemic of violence that doesn't only affect Native communities, it affects us all. We believe this is a human rights issue, and we need to act now. We believe in justice for Native women, and this task force gets us one step closer. Please support House File 3375. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Palmer. If you could please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Caroline Palmer. I'm the Public and Legal Affairs Manager from the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. I'm here to support House File 3375 and to thank Representative Kunish Podine, Representative Becker Finn, and all of the witnesses and survivors who have come here today to support this important legislation. MnCASA represents over 70 sexual assault services programs around the state. We all know and are aware that the disproportionate impact of sexual violence on Native women and girls is well documented here in our state and in the country. Studies show that at least 2.5 times more likely that Native women and girls will be sexually assaulted than any other group in our country. We also know that sexual violence is a significant contributor to lethality and domestic violence, as well as in cases involving acquaintances and strangers. When a person is reduced to an object to be dehumanized, dominated, and abused, sometimes there's no limit to what can happen, including the taking of a life. The statistics show that the harm comes at the hands from someone outside of the tribe more often than not. And our federal and state laws still create barriers to justice on our sovereign lands and beyond. While some progress has been made under the Violence Against Women Act, we still have a very, very long way to go. This task force is a very important first step to changing the narrative, and I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like Representative Kunish Podine's testifiers are done. So I just wanted to first thank the chair for committing to hear this bill and helping us move this forward. I've shared before, but for those who are not aware, I'm a survivor of assault myself, and as a Leech Lake descendant, my great grandmother went missing in 1931, and her body was found eventually, and we still don't know to this day what happened or who did that or the circumstances, but what we do know is that my grandmother, her mom was taken from her when she was 5 years old, and that directly related to my grandmother being sent to a boarding school. And I share this because this isn't a new problem. you know, this is the first time we've brought a bill like this forward in our legislature, but this isn't a new problem at all. It leads back to earliest contact between Native communities and colonizers. And so I think that I'm just really thankful that we're able to bring this forward at this time, and I'm hopeful that we can include this and continue to move forward. And finally, I just wanted to, you know, one of the testifiers touched on this, but as an example in more recent memory, so we all remember Drew Shaheen, and when she went missing, the activation of the community, by the media, by law enforcement, you know, everyone was looking for her. And last year, when Savannah Graywind went missing, a young Native woman from the same area of the state, it wasn't on the news right away. We all, thanks to the internet now, we all as Native women, because we're connected to each other in other ways, we knew that was going on. But the greater community and, you know, the media and law enforcement, oh, well, maybe she ran away. Mm-hmm. You know, she was pregnant and had gone upstairs to visit a neighbor. There was no reason to believe that she had run away. And, of course, you know, we eventually her body was found. And it's painful to think about what might have gone differently had the community been activated in the same way to find her, the way that our communities have been activated to find different folks. So I think Representative Kunish Pradeen and all the others who, you know, represent Zerwas, everyone else who signed on to this bill and is supportive, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving us the time to hear these stories, because it's important that we finally hear these stories and face it and do something about it. So, Midwich, thank you.
Representative Rubin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Horrible stories, really is. But I have a couple of questions for you, Representative Kunish Pradeen. You know, and I'm familiar with the Cass County area and things like that. What are the tribal police doing with these horrible circumstances? Do they have the resources to follow up and you know, a lot of it is due to some issues in terms of drugs and alcohol and things, but is there an active movement among the tribal police forces to address this concern? And secondly, is there coordination between the tribes and the resources that the tribes have to help out on this?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Ogun. You know, this is one of the biggest problems that is part of this whole situation, is the confusion or whose jurisdiction it is to be taking care of any kind of this kind of violence. You have your reservation police, you have your local police, and then you have FBI. And we have to remember that reservation lands are federal lands, and so the FBI has jurisdiction over them as well. In 1978, the Supreme Court stripped the Native Americans from prosecuting at the same rate as the other U.S. jurisdictions could. And now, horrifying enough, non-natives can walk onto the reservation, they can assault, they can rape, they can murder somebody on reservation land and walk off, and the tribe does not have the same ability to prosecute like anywhere else. And so, from what I understand, the federal government then has to be called, the FBI has to be called in to do that, and of course there's distance issues and jurisdictional issues all over again. While the federal government used to decline these cases 76% of the time, they're now at around 40%. And one of the biggest issues with this whole situation is, whose jurisdiction is it? Who is supposed to be in charge of taking charge on these assaults and
issues, and then where is it going to go from there? So that's what this task force is supposed to do, is work within the different police forces and jurisdictions to figure out what is the best path for this.
Representative Rubin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I know that many law enforcement agencies, I believe Cass County has a cross-law enforcement deputized agreement with the tribe and things. Does that type of cooperation help out with this, or what's your opinion on that?
I definitely will. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. It certainly would be, and that's the sort of collaboration that we're looking for. My friend just mentioned that Jeremy Jourdain has been missing since Halloween last year, and no missing persons report by the Leech Lake Police has been filed. And sometimes this is really the first step of not accepting the fact that somebody has gone missing legitimately. I had a story told for me about back over in Standing Rock, a young girl went missing. Her parents waited a day or two, contacted the police. Of course, there was quite a lot of bedlam going on over there, and they kind of poo-pooed it and said, oh, she's probably out partying, maybe she found a new boyfriend, maybe she went on vacation, who knows. And they never took her missing person report. And it took her auntie to go do the investigation, and within a month found, you know, tracked what had happened and found her niece's body and brought the body home. So these are the sort of things that we know about, but we don't know about. And this is the sort of attention that we're trying to bring to the situation.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Becker-Pinn.
Thank you. Just to that point, and Representative Ugram, I think, you know, a lot of Native folks don't actually live on the reservation, and so jurisdictionally, if something were to happen to one of us in Minneapolis or Roseville or wherever, you know, Representative Kunsch-Podine and Representative Flanagan and I all live in the suburbs. We don't live on our home lands, and so that's another difficulty where there's really nothing that our tribal police departments and tribal governments can do when we're not physically, you know, that's not where it happens. So thank you.
Representative Becker-Pinn, it goes to the incident, the jurisdiction goes where the incident occurred at. So, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, too, for bringing this forward. I'm one of the co-authors, and Representative Kunsch-Podine and I had a nice conversation, and it was so enlightening, and I shared, too, that I also, well, he's a foster brother, but I consider him a brother that just went missing, and we, to this day, we don't know where he is or what happened to him. There's been investigators out looking for him, and it's a piece of your heart that you just can never get back. It's just so painful. You know, we also talked about the fact that I grew up in Bagley, so graduated from Bagley High School, which is, I went to church and then school for my undergrad in Bemidji State, in Bemidji, so I always say I grew up sort of in the middle of three of the reservations that are right there, so my heart is there, and I talk a lot about where I grew up because it's, you know, it's a part of who you are, it's a part of your makeup, your DNA is almost there. So I want to thank you so much for being brave and bringing this and being that voice. It's just, I know that there are so many in Greater Minnesota, women and girls that go missing, and it's just, it's a tragedy. And, you know, sex trafficking is all involved, and have, you know, when they mentioned the port of Duluth, I just thought, oh gosh, they're going on ships and now who knows where, yep. Right? So it's terrifying to think about those things, and I just thank you for your bravery to bring this forward, and I'm glad to be a co-author, and I'm glad you're moving this forward, and it is complicated. Mm-hmm. It is so complicated, as you said, that the federal government has jurisdiction over the tribal lands, and so that makes it a challenge for us here as Minnesota State Legislature to figure out what do we do and how do we tackle this. So I look forward to the report from the task force to see what they come up with. And but wow, what bravery today. Thank you for you and all your testifiers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Gossel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kunsch-Podine, for bringing this bill forward. It is good discussion to have. but I can speak for the law enforcement in that area because I worked in that area. Mm-hmm. I worked on the Headwaters Safe Trails Task Force, and we worked narcotics, violent crime on the Red Lake Reservation. We also worked with the Leech Lake Tribal Police and the White Earth Tribal Police as well. So we traveled all around that three reservation and that multi-county jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And we worked very well. We worked very hard to make sure that these types of crimes were addressed and addressed thoroughly. The FBI has the jurisdiction for criminal regulatory for anything that is felony type crimes in Red Lake. Mm-hmm. And so they get after those cases, with my experience, very diligently. And as well as the tribal police investigators and officers, as well as and right along with them, the county investigators and deputies. So, you know, there's some things that need to be addressed. Mm-hmm. But as for the most part, and from my experience working in those areas, there's not a one of those officers, deputies, or federal agents that doesn't take every call seriously and run it to the very end. And a lot of these things, they run for years. Mm-hmm. And they keep working on it. So don't think that anybody's forgotten. Mm-hmm. Because these officers keep moving and they keep digging. And a lot of times it's very tough digging. So I just want to make sure that you understand. From my perspective, I appreciate you bringing this forward, but with my experience working with all those agencies,
yep,
they work very hard to take care of the people that they're supposed to be protecting up there.
Thank you, Representative. I'm sure they do. I'm not saying that they don't take this seriously or don't do their job diligently. It's so complicated. I think you know that. It's so complicated, and when you're looking at jurisdictional situations and all the different nuances to a crime, I'm sure that they do their very best. So thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, I'm grateful to you, Mr. Chair, to Representative Commissioner Green for bringing this forward, and especially to the testifiers for sharing their accounts and just describing things to us. I want to make sure to emphasize to Representative Grasso's point that regardless of the diligence of individual officers, just the so I have some exposure to this in the last couple of years because of the work against sexual exploitation, and just the legal structure that we impose on tribes in terms of trying to investigate cases, just the patchwork of land within a tribal community, depending on exactly who commits the offense and who the victim is and exactly what the crime is and various things, it is just a huge mess that has nothing to do with the diligence of the individual officers. And I've often thought, man, if I had to try to prosecute cases in that situation, that would be really, really hard. I also want to emphasize, though, that this is an epidemic across the entire state. Native women living in Minneapolis and St. Paul, in the suburbs, in the towns in Minnesota, are at far higher risk of becoming missing, murdered, experiencing sexual violence, experiencing domestic violence, than our other women and girls. We know that sexual exploitation, this is an area of expertise for me, kids of color disproportionately targeted, LGBT kids disproportionately targeted, but Native women and girls, way beyond even those groups, absolutely the most. And it is built on decades and centuries of violence. As I said, I've learned more about this because of the exploitation work, and it's just mind-blowing. Even some of the stuff that was going on that people put down in their journals in the 1600s that I've seen in some presentations, they continue right on all the way through the present day, that we value these lives societally less than others. And it is unconscionable, and this task force is at the very least that we can do in beginning to address that and to make sure that we're supporting every single person in our state. So thank you for bringing this forward. It's really important. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone from the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Okay, with that, any last remarks?
I would like to just thank you again, Chair, for allowing me to bring this in front of you as well as the rest of the members here. Minnesota, we as legislators and we as the state of Minnesota have an opportunity to address this moral crisis. The time is now. The time is right. I think we are all becoming more and more aware of this situation. We have now resources that are going to make it
a better way to address the situation, and I would just ask you all to wrap your arms around these Native communities that have suffered for hundreds and hundreds of years, and take the first step to righting a wrong that should never have really started in the first place. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And with that, the bill will be laid over.
Thank you.
Next, we have House File 3554, Representative Fisker. And Representative Wilson, if you wish to move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 3554 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Welcome to the committee, please. Welcome to the committee, committee testimony chair.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, this actually is an agency bill, and so I am going to let the Chief Financial Officer from the Department of Corrections talk about the conflict in law and why this bill is necessary.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chris Dodge. I am the Chief Financial Officer for the State of Minnesota Department of Corrections. We're asking for this bill because we recently underwent an audit with the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and they discovered an inconsistency in statutes. And in the community corrections section of the statute, there's language that states that counties who commit kids to a juvenile correctional facility will pay the entire cost of confinement for that person. And there's another statute that was enacted in 1997 in the corrections section of the statutes that says that counties will pay 65% of the actual per diem, excluding education. And so we have been operating with the statute in section 242 since 1997. And in verbal recommendations with the OLA, they recommended that we seek to repeal the statute in section 401 to make it clear that the intent is that counties pay 65% of that cost of care.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Is there anyone in the audience wish to testify on this bill? Okay, thank you. And with that, the bill will be laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Ruiz. Next, we have House File 3657. And the Representative Ruiz, if you wish to move your bill, you may do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the bill be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, this bill was brought to me by the St. Paul Police Department Bomb Squad. House File 3657 is a bill that updates our current state statute reflecting the changing times of our country and the unfortunate current hand of the four bomb squads that are deployed throughout the state of Minnesota, to protect at large-scale events. really digging into the bill, Mr. Chair, I have an amendment, the A18-0680 amendment. I'd like to move that amendment.
Okay. Although in case of the amendments, they
and Mr. Chair, just briefly, if I could speak to the amendment.
Oh, go ahead.
And Mr. Chair, on the amendment, on 1.11 through 1.12, there's language that struck the language on line 1.11. Reimbursement is limited to the extent of appropriated funds. Right now, it's struck out. I'd like to make an oral amendment to retain that language within the amendment.
Okay. Does anybody from the committee have any comments or questions on the oral amendment? Representative Considine?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why was it struck out in the first place?
Representative Zuwalter?
Mr. Chair, members, when advocates brought the bill forward to me, the plan was to keep this within the current appropriation amount and to tweak what expenses would be reimbursable by reinstating the strikeout language. We're able to keep it to the appropriation amount.
Representative Constantine?
Any chance you would actually be willing to help the bomb squad? In an actual live exercise? Just kidding, Representative.
Mr. Chair, I mean, I think I felt my pacemaker speed up a little bit there. I'm looking at Pats. I watched those guys put on the suits, and I think that is not my gig.
Good, then.
All those in favor of the amendment to the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. The amendment passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll now move the underlying amendment.
Okay. All those in favor of the underlying amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Aye.
The bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members. And thank you for your cooperation in getting the bill in the shape I'd like to move forward. As I was getting into, we have four bomb squads throughout the state of Minnesota that respond to various large-scale events, events with dignitary visits, and then, of course, everyday calls that come in involving suspicious and potentially suspicious explosive devices. And we're in a world where we see, unfortunately, more and more calls for service on these four teams. Within your package is a management analysis and development report. I'm talking about the department's statewide response teams. And on the second page, third bullet down, it talks about Homeland Security and Emergency Management should also consider restructuring reimbursement for bomb squads to link rates to estimated costs for service, and the department might consider seeking legislative appropriation for funds that could be used to reimburse bomb squad for response costs that exceed their annual allotments. And so just for everyone's refresher for everyone, that we did in the budget bill last year include $100,000 per biennium in additional funding, and this bill would go back then and readjust how those reimbursements are handled and connecting them more directly to costs incurred. The bill does not ask for any more money, but it does ask for the reimbursements for bomb squads to align with today's costs for providing safety to the public and at these events. The City of St. Paul brought this issue to my attention, and we have Sergeant John Riley with the St. Paul Police Department's Bomb Squad team here to testify in support of this bill. And at this point, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before you go to your testifier, just educate me out of ignorance here, and I'll admit I'm ignorant on this piece, but this report from Management Analysis and Development, I take it that is a subset of MMD, or is it some agency that was hired? I'm just a little confused by who Management Analysis and Development are.
Yep. Mr. Chair, members, I apologize for not being more clear. If you look at the bottom portion of the report in the yellow box there, it talks about Minnesota Management Budget. And so this is a division out of MMB. And so I apologize for not being clear in my presentation.
Good morning, Sergeant Riley.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is John Riley. I'm a sergeant with the St. Paul Police Department. I've been a police officer for 22 years, and I've been on the St. Paul Police Department for, the St. Paul Bomb Squad for 16 years. All the members of our bomb squad are what's called a hazardous devices technician, or in layman's terms, bomb technicians. Three members who proudly served with me on the bomb squad sit behind me today. I want to thank our bill's chief author, Representative Zerlas, and the co-authors, Representative Mariani, Representative Lesh, and Representative Omar. Mr. Chair and the committee, I'm here to ask your support for HF 3657, the bomb disposal unit expense reimbursement bill. This bill updates Minnesota law to reflect the growing response demand for our explosive experts, both as they grow both nationally and here in the state of Minnesota. First, I'd like to provide a little bit of context. The state of Minnesota has four bomb squads. They're hosted by the cities of St. Paul, Minneapolis, Bloomington, and Crow Wing County. Our teams are state assets, and we respond statewide. When we receive a call for service outside of our municipality, we transition from a municipal bomb squad to a state asset bomb squad. And subsequently, when we leave our home municipality, the state of Minnesota then reimburses our home city for that response. Unfortunately, threats in today's society are growing, and they're different from when our existing state law with regard to bomb squad reimbursement, they've changed from when that law was originally crafted. Demand for our assistance has increased due to the number of bombings in the country, the number of attacks on dignitaries, celebrities, public officials, even everyday Minnesotans, as well as bomb threats and scares. The need for our services has grown, and we receive many more requests today than we did even in our recent history, as recent as 10 years ago. Many people can recall the attacks on Times Square or the Boston Marathon bombings, or more recently, the various school shootings that involved both weapons and explosives, and even more recent than that, the serial bomber in Austin, Texas, which just occurred. All of these events have contributed to the demands on our states for bomb squads increasing, and the request for our assistance is going up and up as time goes on. Our bill is simple, and it addresses three main areas. The first area aligns Minnesota with national standards and adds police explosive detection canines as a qualifying reimbursement expense during an official state bomb squad response. Stated more clearly, currently in Minnesota, and the law related to bomb squad reimbursements does not, as far as reimbursements are concerned, they don't address explosive detection canines. However, I can tell you as a 16-year bomb technician that we need our explosive canines to be with us. If they're not with us, we don't do the job as well because we don't have the abilities that the canines have. Currently, Minnesota law fails to recognize them, and the first portion of this bill recognizes them as an essential asset to our bomb squad response. When we leave our city with a canine handler, it would include the ability to get reimbursed for the canine handler's response with us. The second portion of our bill expands the allowable reimbursable state asset bomb squad's responses to include dignitary explosive protection sweeps, large state event explosive sweeps, and it provides for explosive security during these large events. What does that mean? As an example, when the president, whoever the president is at that time, travels to Minnesota and then speaks at a venue outside of our home agency, our bomb squads respond at the request of the Secret Service and the local law enforcement authorities. We do explosive sweeps, is what we call them. We do explosive checks of the area just prior to arrival. Sometimes the venues are large, and then we remain on scene as explosive security throughout the event in case there's a threat that we need to respond to. We remain on scene because sometimes we are a distance away from our home municipality, and frankly, it would take too long for us to drive from St. Paul to Mankato, for example, or St. Paul to Rochester, as another example, to respond to an item near the protected dignitary or the protected event that that they need to be cleared faster than our response travel time plus our activities on the scene. So we're asking, currently state law doesn't reimburse for dignitary protection bomb sweeps. It doesn't allow for that reimbursement. It also doesn't allow for us to remain on scene as we're on either a large event or a dignitary event. And the third item of the bill provides for a reimbursement formula to more accurately reflect the actual costs that our bomb squads or our cities incur when we leave our home municipality and we travel to the area where the request or the assistance is being provided. Currently, state law doesn't address the reimbursement amount at all. It only enumerates the total allowed expenditures per year, which Representative Zerwas stated was increased in a biennium last year. The amount each bomb squad gets currently is $37,000 per year, and this formula key point number three refers to doesn't affect the $37,000 at all. It simply affects the hourly rate at which the bomb squads get reimbursed to more accurately reflect the real cost of our response. We ask for your support. It will enable us to continue to protect Minnesota and the citizens of Minnesota, and we thank you for your time and attention. I'm available for any questions.
Representative Carson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. If you're willing to mess around with bombs, I'm really willing to make sure you have what you need, including dogs. One of the things, though, it appears that the bomb squads are all concentrated except for the one in Crow Wing County, and you mentioned particularly Mankato, where I'm from. It would seem to me that it might be a good idea if we had a couple more dispersed, like where the URT teams are, maybe one in Moorhead or Duluth, maybe one in Mankato, so that we cut down on some of that travel time. At some point, maybe we should look at that. But again, if you're willing to go out and mess around with bombs, I'd like to see you have what you need. Thank you.
Representative Hester.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me, are all of the bomb squads in agreement that we should make these changes, or?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe they are. However, we're the only bomb squad represented here today. I did speak with them verbally, and of course they do support the inclusion of explosive detection canines and the inclusion of duty terror protection bomb sweeps and a reformulation that more of the reimbursement formula that more accurately represents our actual costs. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hirschman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that it isn't a redistribution of the money from one to the other.
Oh, absolutely.
Just actually reimbursing for costs.
Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you for pointing it out. To be clear, each of the four bomb squads gets $37,000 for the year of which they can get reimbursed from. If we don't need that level of reimbursement, then we, of course, we only get reimbursed for the actual calls we take. The amount is flat across all of the bomb squads, and so it isn't a tilting of the scale one direction or the other.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe this is to the bill author, or possibly to the officer. So, I realize that we're lining this for federal guidelines and a lot of other things. Was this a problem where bomb squads not getting reimbursed for their actual expenses? And then in addition to that, if that's not the case, if this is going to ultimately get them reimbursed at the level they should be, do we have enough money in this pool to make sure that that will happen?
And so I can, Mr. Chair, I can start. I think the concern was what qualified and what didn't qualify for reimbursement. I think some of the security sweeps that were qualified, there's examples of one or more bomb squads traveling up to Duluth doing a security sweep for Grandma's Marathon. That portion is covered. However, after this initial security sweep is done, one or more bomb squad may stay on site because there will inevitably be a random backpack or bag that is alerted to authorities. And as the sergeant mentioned, it doesn't make sense to travel back and forth. And under current law, that portion, as I understand, isn't eligible for reimbursement, just the original security sweep. And then the other portion that this would call out is these dignitary visits that currently aren't eligible for reimbursement. If you have someone coming into town and there's a requirement for a security sweep because of that, that was an issue that folks were lying into. The fiscal note that you got in your packet talked about an increased cost if every expense imaginable was going to be reimbursed, and that was around $900,000 a year. To be clear, and that's what the importance of the oral amendment is, to be clear, I'm not asking to grow the size of the pie or shift where the money goes. We're just trying to more accurately reflect true costs and true expenses to the reimbursement. We understand that you get to November and December of the calendar year, and likely in some instances, a bomb squad's allocation may be zero, and there will be no money left for the reimbursement. We understand that, and that's not what we're not trying to circumvent that in any way.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. We keep bringing up these dignitaries that come. Do we not get reimbursed for officers' time and all those other types of things when, you know, someone like the president or the vice president comes here and, you know, we have hundreds of man hours addressing the event? Is that something, does that fall out on us as a state, or is there some level of reimbursement from the administration relative to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative, well, some of that answer would fall outside of my lane, if you will, because I haven't focused on how the entirety of the police department or any given police department gets reimbursed. My understanding is that the answer to that question is usually no, that it doesn't. When a dignitary visits in the form of a senior politician, et cetera, that they don't bring along a budget for security. It's just simply a function of our mission. And normally, that mission is carried out by the local agency. In other words, if the president comes to the city of St. Paul, our local agency bears that cost, and then our local bomb squad bears that cost as well, because we're within our municipality, and there's no reimbursement included. On the other hand, if they go to Rochester, the local agency there would bear the cost along with the state patrol. The unique element of that response would be the bomb squad, because we leave our municipality to go make that, you know, perform that those duties down there. And current law doesn't specifically enumerate that is a covered, reimbursable event.
One of the testifiers, Joel Kelly, Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, he might have a little bit.
Okay, I'll wait until he's done with my follow-up.
Okay. And with that, Representative Howell?
I can wait until we get further down.
Deputy Director Joel Kelly from Homeland Security can come up.
We saved all the hard questions for you. Morning.
Director Kelly, welcome to the committee. Can you introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning. My name is Joe Kelly. I serve as the Director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. Your latest amendment represents, throws my script off, but that's in a good way. The amendment to reinstate the restriction of the reimbursements to the extent of funds appropriated takes a significant amount of concern that the department had off, and it obviously changes the substantial fiscal note that we calculated when we took it verbatim as written. So I'm grateful for that. I would like to, Mr. Chair, start and end my remarks by expressing how truly grateful we are for the four local law enforcement agencies that contract with the Department of Public Safety. These are the police departments, as you've heard, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Bloomington, as well as the Crow Wing County Sheriff's Office, that are there to help us when we receive calls for assistance from across the state. These teams are technically proficient, highly professional, and very effective
at protecting the public from dangerous explosive materials and devices on an almost daily basis. These guys are very good at what they do. They are extremely dedicated to public service and public safety. We are on their side. Even as you might hear, we express some concerns with the bill. We're on their side. We're also grateful to the legislature, as Representative Zuras pointed out last year, in response to the study completed by the Management Analysis Division. We made a recommendation through the governor's office to increase the appropriation for bomb squad reimbursement. We received half of what we asked for, and for that we are grateful, because that allowed us to increase the allowance, if you will, for each of the bomb squads by 50%, because we were operating probably at a point where a lot of the response costs were being subsidized by those hosting jurisdictions, and we agree that that is simply not fair. But even with the latest oral amendment, the department still has some concerns and questions with the proposed changes to Minnesota Statutes 299C, as we understand it. And let me start with a real quick explanation of the current arrangement we have with our partner jurisdictions. We enter into joint powers agreements. The most recent ones were signed in January of 2018. And that current agreements agree to reimburse the bomb squads or pay the bomb squads at a rate of $175 an hour when they respond outside their home jurisdictions. There is no reference in statute as to how much the bomb squads should be paid. The language, current language, is that the commissioner may pay reasonable costs. And we negotiate those joint powers agreements with the departments every other year. This negotiated rate is intended to cover at least the responding department's additional costs. It's going to cost you extra money to go to Mankato. It's going to cost you mileage, potentially overtime, supplies as you deal with the dangerous device. That is the, we think we need to at least cover that. And we do believe that the current rate, at least as agreed upon by the departments, does that. Additionally, it's important to know, as the sergeant pointed out, these teams, when they leave their jurisdiction under the, for lack of the right term, under the orders of the state, they are operating as agents of the state, so we provide liability and workers' compensation coverage for them as well, because it wouldn't be fair if one of those officers got hurt for the city of St. Paul to have to bear that burden. So the state covers them for that. An important component of our arrangement that hasn't been talked about yet is that we provide additional financial resources to the bomb squads through an annual federal Homeland Security grant to help them with the costs of training, equipping, and supplying their teams. Additionally, as monies allow, we do our best to help them upgrade their major equipment items like vehicles, trailers, etc. So, for example, in addition to the reimbursements for bomb runs this year, we granted St. Paul an additional $90,000 to support their operations, plus $180,000 to help them buy a new bomb response vehicle. So in addition to the reimbursements are not the entire financial picture of the arrangement that we have with these bomb squads. The language that's proposed, minus the oral amendment, would fundamentally change that current model in four significant ways. First is that it would require, it would require the department to fully reimburse these departments for all of their actual operating costs when they support the state, including their base salaries, not just overtime, but their base salaries, fringe benefits, etc. And St. Paul estimates, in a phone call we had earlier in the week, that would double the rate that they would need to receive if we go from additional, you know, marginal costs to actual costs, as if they're actually unplugging from their city and plugging into state service where the state is paying for everything. Second, the amendment would expand, as we've discussed, the authorized reimbursements from beyond those explosive device runs to include the protective sweeps as well as other event security. Third, the language authorizes reimbursable deployments at the request of any law enforcement agency in the state, presumably for all of those, that expanded list of reimbursable operations, including special event security. Currently, local law enforcement, when they need one of the bomb squads, they make a call to the Minnesota Duty Officer of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And those requests are approved by HSAM's on-call emergency response coordinators. If you read the language literally, which is the only way we have, it has the effect of putting the authority to authorize a bomb run, if you will, and encumber reimbursement to the local law enforcement agency requesting it and the bomb squad commander receiving the call. And we think that the authority for deploying the bomb squad should be consistent as it is with the other state teams, which include our 11 hazmat response teams, as well as our collapse structure rescue force. Because as we said, remember, when these teams deploy outside their jurisdiction, they really are functioning as agents of the state, and we believe they should go under the authority, under the order of the state. We see this as potentially being especially problematic when we get into special event security, which it's not an urgent life and death right now matter, and there's a bit of judgment involved as to whether a sweep is used. The fourth concern has been primarily addressed with the removal of the limit, reinstatement of the limit on the to the extent of funds appropriated. But also problematic is the changing in the language that the commissioner must reimburse for not only the actual costs, but then all explosive device responses, security sweeps, event security, both in and out of jurisdiction. It's not that the cost, the appropriation, will stay the same, but the net effect of that is we're going to burn through that money in a hurry. Because it won't just be for bomb runs, it will be for special events. And it will also be, again, the way the law or the amendment is written, it will be for in-jurisdiction runs, which currently is the responsibility of those municipalities. We often say when we talk to our friends, you know, Minneapolis has a bomb squad, because Minneapolis needs a bomb squad on a daily basis. And when someone else needs it, Mankato or Renville County, wherever, we rent that from them and pay the marginal cost to get there. The way the law, the way the wording is now, that would be problematic for us. So the department does want to fairly compensate these bomb squads. And we are all in favor of them getting additional resources so they can do some of these extra things. We support providing security for dignitary visits, because to answer Representative Dean's question, no, when the Secret Service says we're coming to town, there is no reimbursement for any law enforcement that is necessary to provide protection to that dignitary. That is the responsibility of local law enforcement, bomb squad, notwithstanding. We truly appreciate the support of providing additional security at special events. I would tell you that when we look at the large special events in Minnesota that the United States Department of Homeland Security tracks, there are 300 large special events that have more than 10,000 people at them. We are talking about potentially a big special event. So, in conclusion, I just want to once again thank Minneapolis, St. Paul, Bloomington, and Crow Wing County for making these critical life-saving services available. We want to do everything we can to support them. Our primary concern with the language is that, absent any additional money, but the extended authorizations and reimbursables, we're going to go through that money in a hurry, and I fear that when we actually do need to go on a device run, particularly later in the year, we'll have to ask that team to do it without being reimbursed. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, and Representative Zerwas. Do you have any questions?
Members, I know there's a couple of members that have questions. Just a reminder, we will be resuming the room for 8 o'clock tonight or shortly thereafter, because we have 4 bills to go and we're running out of time.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll just be brief. Is there money left over at the end that you don't end up spending ever?
Director Kelly? Mr. Chair, and Representative Hillstrom, the short answer is no. Even if there is a little bit, because, and hopefully, you know, even less so now, that there is never before because they were funded at $25,000 a year. If there ever was a little bit of spare change, we were able to cross-level that, if you will, from a squad that didn't spend all of their money, even if it was only a few hundred bucks, to get it to one that had an expense that because we ran out of money, we weren't able to fully reimburse them. So the short answer is no.
Representative Howell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only concern is I don't have a problem providing the sweeps for dignitaries. My issue is I think we should have something for some reimbursement for the famous people, or if they're going to have a concert or something like that. I think if you're going to go do a sweep, there should be a fee in there, involved in there, and get some recoup for something to that. When you've got the famous people in there, I think they should pony up. That's my point.
Yeah, and if I can just add on to it, sometimes when dignitaries come here, they hold events that they raise money for other individuals or for other causes, and that maybe those causes or those organizations or those individuals that are receiving campaign donations should maybe cover some of that cost too.
Any final words?
Mr. Chair and members, I've had this bill introduced since I think the second or third week of the session, and this is the first I'm hearing from the department. So with that, I'll continue to work with the department and see if there's ways we can improve the language.
Okay, and with that, the bill will be laid over. Representative Grasso, and we'll be starting with House File 2904. I'm going to move House File 2904 for possible, lay it over for possible inclusion. Representative Grasso, welcome. You may thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'll be presenting House File 2904 today. It is related to public safety, increasing penalties for child pornography offenses, creating a mandatory minimum sentence, directing the sentencing guidelines commission to modify the sex offender grid, and amending some statutes in there as well. I was also going to make a verbal amendment, if I may, and that would be, on page 2, line 2.20, it would be 50, instead of 50, it would be 25. Is that the only oral amendment that you have?
Yes, sir.
Is there any questions on the oral amendment?
Representative
Harrison, do you have any questions on the oral amendment?
Mr. Chair, not on the oral amendment, but why don't we take that and then I'll ask another question about that.
All those in favor of the oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Well, you go ahead with the presentation of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. I just wanted to start out with a quick video clip.
looking at child pornography doesn't give you a sexual gratification. It did a while ago.
The voice on the recordings, never heard publicly until now, is Jacob Kim. It was 2012, as investigators interrogated him, here in his living room, about videos of child sexual abuse.
Did you share any of the clips with anybody, send anybody? Okay, did you receive any penalty call?
Court records detail graphic videos found on his computer, including of children being raped. Very young children.
How old do you think they are, roughly? Just 5, 6, 7, high school. Is there an age that you consider too young?
The admitted pedophile was convicted in 2013 of possession of child pornography and sentenced to 120 days in the local jail and probation. Not a single day in state prison. But now, the newly released recordings raise the question, did those old interviews foreshadow what was about to happen while he was still out on probation?
Authorities are searching for a missing 5-year-old girl.
The search for the missing girl was launched when her babysitter, Melissa Norby, was found dead, arms bound, in her burned-out home. Attention soon focused on Kin, who was dating the babysitter. Investigators found text messages indicating he plotted to acquire the girl for the purpose of sexually assaulting her. They tracked his cell phone signal to a remote location where they found the girl, assaulted and bound in duct tape.
She's safe, no lie.
So far, no charges have been filed in the babysitter's death, but Kin is awaiting trial, accused of kidnapping and sexual assault. Something the 2012 tape suggests he may have been fantasizing about years earlier.
You know that these children that you watched in these clips, they're under the age of 10.
In fact, at one point, Kin claimed the reason he watched the child rape videos was to relieve the urge to act out himself.
I used to look at it, I guess, as to relieve want to do.
Sentences like the original one that Kin received a few months in a local jail as opposed to state prison are among the reasons some state lawmakers want to toughen Minnesota's child pornography and other sex crimes laws, which critics describe as among the weakest in the entire country.
Here in Minnesota, we have some of the weakest?
We do, as far as policies. And our Sentencing Guidelines Commission very often calls for probation for many of these crimes. We actually found and looked at even child rape and sex assault.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that video, a tragedy came later with that murder and the eventual rape and kidnapping of that child. Everybody's pretty familiar with that, with the outcome. The person was charged and convicted and imprisoned. But with that being said, I look at the child pornography statute as it sits. We have many examples of defendants not willing to cooperate with other crimes because as child pornography, if they're hooked up on a child pornography charge, they have to be threatened with federal charges before there's cooperation. Or before there's really any prison time. I'll use Jacob Wetterlund's abductor as an example. They got him on pornography charges later in years. And until he was threatened with the federal child pornography charges, he would not cooperate as to where Jacob's body was. That's one example. I have testifiers here that will add more to what I'm seeing as far as being a very weak statute in our criminal law. So with that being said, I will introduce my testifier here, Nicole McKinnon, and her daughter Maya.
Hey, before we get to the testimony, I want to double check on line 4.2. Do you need an oral amendment to also change that to 25 years?
Yes, sir.
Okay. With that, the chair moves an oral amendment on line 4.2 after lease, change 50 to 25. Any questions? All those in favor of the oral amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The amendment is approved. Go ahead with your testimony. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
My name is Nicole McKinnon. And this is my daughter, Maya. I told her what I was coming here to do today, and she thought it was important to be here with me. This is really important to her, too. I was asked to come here today by Mr. Groswell to talk to you about my experience with the current laws and sentencing guidelines for sexual predators and child pornography offenders. This is not an easy thing for me to do and is certainly not easy for my 14-year-old daughter. Being here today is not within my comfort zone by any means, but we have been through hell in the past year, and our story is important for you to hear. Our pain and frustrations come not only from the situation we found ourselves in, but also the laws that are in place which we feel failed us as victims. Victims of sexual predators feel a lot of shame and embarrassment. They also carry a lot of guilt and responsibility for what happened to them. The sentencing guidelines as they are now help to promote the feelings of guilt within the victims to the point where they think maybe they should be punished as well. And many of them punish themselves for the rest of their lives. During the sentencing hearing in the case I'm about to discuss, we heard story after story of young girls cutting themselves and attempting suicide after their abuse finally ended. Because of that, the punishment for this type of crime needs to be much more severe. We need to show these kids, like my daughter, that this behavior is not tolerated. The violation of children in Minnesota can no longer be a slap on the wrist offense. And the kids should not feel like they need to share the blame and punish themselves. Just over a year ago, my daughter was a normal 13-year-old middle school teenager. Actually, she's a pretty extraordinary kid in my eyes, but I might be a little biased. In March of 2017, her biggest worry in life was the fact that she was getting braces put on her teeth in a few weeks, and maybe a little friend or boy drama here or there. She was enjoying school and enjoying life. She was into snowboarding and skateboarding and was a member of the middle school swim team. The year before, she'd been voted class president and through student council had formed some pretty close relationships with teachers and administrators at the school. Maya's teachers really liked her, mostly because she was so helpful and thoughtful. She would constantly beg me in the car on the way to school to stop and get a donut for Mr. Whoever because he looked sad yesterday, or ask if we could get coffee for Mrs. Whoever because her pet turtle died or something. She had this level of empathy and compassion that's rare in middle school kids these days. Her teachers noticed this and even seemed to treat her a little bit differently from other students. She had privileges awarded to her that other students didn't have. She was allowed to hang out in certain teachers' classrooms in the morning before school and even charge her cell phone in the assistant principal's office during the day and stop in between classes to check messages or to send a quick text. The progression of this was slow and seemed so natural that it didn't raise red flags like I really wish it had. I was simply proud of my daughter who was flourishing in school, and I was excited to see that so many other people thought she was as amazing as I think she is. There are so many things we know we need to protect our children from. I thought I'd done a really good job keeping my children safe. None of them had even broken a bone or had anything particularly scary happen to them. I was fine with letting my kids feel angry or disappointed if I had to tell them no, they couldn't do something because it was unsafe. When I drop them off at school, I worry about all sorts of things. Bullies, boys acting inappropriately, is their homework getting done, the big math test coming up, the gray stuff my daughter said she had for lunch yesterday. But I never really thought to worry about keeping my kids safe from the people I trusted to educate them. In late March of 2017, I was hit with a massive dose of reality, which felt more like a baseball bat to the head. Someone had been sexually grooming my daughter via social media. He told her he was a middle school boy from Duluth who had recently lost his mother and was dealing with all sorts of issues at home with his father. He felt alone and afraid. My daughter, being the compassionate person she is, felt terrible for this boy she didn't even know. She wanted to help him and do anything she could to make his life better. They spoke often, as teenagers do, via Facebook and Snapchat, and they became close. He slowly pushed for the communication to turn sexual in nature, as he showered her with compliments and made her feel she was really helping him get through this difficult time in his life. He persuaded her to send nude photographs to him. Investigators from the sheriff's office came to my office one morning to let me know what was happening and ask permission to interview my daughter at school because the boy from Duluth was not who he said he was. He was a grown man, and Maya was not the only victim. I did everything they asked. I allowed them to interview Maya. I allowed them into my home to photograph my daughter's bedroom and her bathroom. I was in complete shock. The anger and disbelief I felt was unimaginable. Some man was grooming and using my daughter for his own sick pleasure. There were nude pictures of my little girl being used for disgusting purposes. The investigators couldn't tell me who the man was until they had him in custody. It took 2 days for that to happen. In the meantime, I brought Maya to church and we talked with our pastor about what had happened. We set up a plan and worked through this and the relearning of appropriate behavior. I brought her to a counselor. I'm also not proud to say I yelled at her. I was angry and disappointed that my kid had been so stupid. I was angry at myself for not being more like the helicopter parents I ignorantly prided myself on not being like. I also made some phone calls to the school to start building a support system for Maya. I had wanted to let the people Maya trusted most in the school know that something disturbing had happened and that Maya might need some special considerations over the next few days. I called the assistant principal. When he didn't answer, I tried his cell phone. I had his personal phone number because he was so close with Maya and had helped her through many issues in the past and would reach out to me after. I was disappointed when he didn't answer his cell either. The next day, the investigator's black SUV rolled into my driveway, and I felt the smallest bit of relief. I hoped this meant the pervert was in custody and we could move on, a valuable life lesson learned. Unfortunately, what he was about to tell us ended up being more devastating than we ever could have imagined. The assistant principal at the Bemidji Middle School had been arrested and charged as a sexual predator, and he had already confessed. The assistant principal had been engaging in disturbing sexual conversations with my little girl. Conversations that the investigator said sickened him, a seasoned detective, and he hoped I never had to learn the full extent of it. The assistant principal had nude photos of my child, which he used for his own sexual pleasure. He told me this and my heart dropped, knowing I now had to tell Maya. I called her into the room and I hugged her. I told her everything was going to be okay and that I was here for her no matter what. Then the investigator and I told her the truth about the situation together. It took her a few minutes to fully understand what we were saying. The impossibility of it was almost comical to her at first. But it didn't take long for her world to come crashing down. The color drained from her face and she started to sob. The investigator, a big bear of a man, had to excuse himself as his eyes filled with tears. As he was walking to the door, with a broken voice, he managed to explain that he had a daughter too, and he was going to make certain that justice would be served. He left, and my three other children came into the room. We all held each other and cried for hours. I don't think any of us got much sleep that night. The next day, I was on a mission. I marched into the school and demanded to speak with the head principal. I was angry, probably looked a little scary, and I don't think anyone at the school dared to tell me no at that point. I had questions that I wanted answered. I needed a plan for Maya's future, and I needed it now. After that lengthy meeting at the school, I headed to the district offices to speak with the head of human resources. I again showed up unannounced and demanded a meeting, which I was given immediately. The whole angry mother on a mission thing is pretty effective. At this meeting, I was told that the assistant principal was still employed. He was put on administrative leave and would continue to receive his pay unless a conviction was made. I left that meeting even more fired up. By now, it was time to head over to the courthouse for the arraignment, which I was not going to miss. I needed to look that man in the eyes. I sat in the front row. I must have still had that angry, scary mother appearance because they posted two bailiffs on either side of me during the hearing, probably for good reason. But the reason I'm here today starts at this point in my story. Because this man was a first-time offender, he was given the option of posting a low bail amount with conditions attached, such as no access to the internet and no contact with children. Or he could post a much higher bail with no conditions at all. He ended up posting the higher bail and was released, just like that, able to return to his family, able to do anything he wanted. This man, who had just confessed to preying on kids, was free to go sit at the playground on his laptop if he wanted to. He was ultimately given the opportunity to buy himself access to children. I was furious that this was allowed. But unfortunately, it was actually about to get a whole lot worse. The prosecuting attorney invited me up to his office after the arraignment to talk about what would happen next. When we arrived in his office, he explained to me what just happened in court was completely normal, pretty much exactly what he expected to happen. Not surprisingly, this didn't calm me down much. Someone known to violate children, a dangerous predator, was free to go with no conditions, and this was all perfectly normal. I learned he could walk up to my front door if he wanted to. I was terrified for my family. I started to think of people we could stay with, places we could hide. It was beginning to become obvious that the legal system was not interested in keeping us safe. The prosecutor then put a sex offender sentencing guideline grid in front of me. This was something I had never seen before, didn't even know such a thing existed. He explained that the principal, with his new high-dollar attorney, was a squeaky clean, highly educated first-time offender, which meant he came in with zero criminal points. He also explained that the severity of what they knew about the crimes up to this point were considered a very low level G. I believe there were only two or three charges at this point, which meant the sentencing guidelines suggested a presumptive stayed sentence, no jail time, and no registration on the sex offender list. My daughter's abuser was labeled a first-time offender by the court system. Maybe technically that's true, but the benefits given to first-time offenders are huge. And he had confessed to preying on innocent children for his own sexual satisfaction for at least 3 years. He took what he knew about these kids by getting to know them at school, his place of appointment, and used his position of authority to groom them and use them for sexual purposes. But he's considered a first-time offender. Does that seem right to you? Does he really deserve a break because he was smart enough to figure out how to carry on this disgusting scheme for a really long time without being caught? This left me with horrible thoughts that kept me up at night. Should I hope that more kids were hurt by this man so he would receive more criminal points? What a sick thought. I hated myself for thinking that way. But it felt as though my daughter's pain, the abuse she suffered, didn't mean anything. The sentencing grid was like a sick board game, and we were losing. How would I explain this to my daughter? What happened to you is really bad, but the court system doesn't think so, so this horrible person isn't going to have consequences. Do you understand how that makes a kid feel? It makes them feel like blame and consequences are due somewhere. A terrible crime was committed, and the offender isn't receiving consequences, then the victims must hold some responsibility themselves. I'm convinced that if my daughter's abuser had been dealt with appropriately, she would have been spared a lot of unnecessary pain. She would have fully realized the severity of what happened and let the blame rest on the principal himself. She would have walked away with a life lesson instead of carrying around baggage filled with guilt and responsibility. At the end of the investigation, it was found that over 55 children had been victims of the assistant principal at the middle school. 55 children and hundreds of family members' lives changed by this sick man. I thought surely this would be enough to put him away and throw away the key. But again, I was very wrong, and this was not the case. Because of the definition of child pornography, as defined in Minnesota, many of the pictures the principal was in possession of did not constitute child pornography. me make sure I'm clear here. A man in position of authority at a middle school has nude pictures on his computer of the very children he sees and mentors every day, and only a few are legally considered child pornography. Pardon my frankness here, but why? What are you people doing? Why is the law like this? It is so wrong. How is this protecting our children in Minnesota? Take a minute and think about your own children, your grandchildren, your nieces and nephews. I didn't put much thought into this until it happened to my family, so I understand others not giving it the complete attention it deserves, but I'm asking you to do that now. Do it before it touches your loved ones. Fix these problems and make the changes that need to be made to these laws. Our story has an ending that I can live with, but only because the federal government agreed to take over the case and was able to sentence him based on federal guidelines. This man was looking at a maximum of only a few years in jail before the assistant U.S. attorney took over and saved the day. She is a hero in my eyes. I am so relieved to be able to tell you that the man who hurt my child was sentenced to 25 years in federal prison for what he did, plus lifetime supervision after he's released. He will be registered as a federal sex offender, and a long list of measures will be taken to prevent him from ever hurting anyone else. But this doesn't change the fact that we were first failed by Minnesota. More children are failed by Minnesota every day the laws stay as they are. Minnesota wanted to send this disgusting sexual predator back to his comfortable life with barely a slap on the wrist. The federal government understands the severity of this problem and sentences these predators appropriately. Minnesota needs to do the same. We need to fix the sentencing guidelines because they are outdated and they do not serve justice. They do not protect the children of Minnesota, and they cause more harm than good. Mr. Grossel has a good start here with his bill, and I'm so thankful to him for feeling personally responsible for protecting Minnesota's children. I hope you all feel the same way, as you should, as elected officials. This bill is a good start, but there's still more that can be done. If you're sitting here worrying about this bill going too far, as I've heard some people feel, just ask yourself how far you would go to protect my daughter sitting here today. How far would you go to protect the children in your own lives? This bill does not go too far. Please, let's give the sick predators in our state one more reason to leave our children alone. This is our story, our extremely painful experience, and now I can pray and trust that you'll do your job and do the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you for giving us your experience, unfortunate experience that you went through. Is there any questions for this witness? Or testifier, I should say. Next, we have Drew Evans from the director, the superintendent of the BCA.
Good morning, Superintendent. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'll be very brief, as I understand you're under a tight time frame here. Representative Grossel just asked me to share a little bit about the issue of child pornography from our perspective in the state of Minnesota. The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has 18 agents dedicated to this type of work, along with human trafficking and predatory offender investigations. We're the ICAT commander for the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, which operates across the state of Minnesota, which has approximately 100 affiliates, other law enforcement agencies that are working on this very important work. Minnesota last year had 2,148 cyber tips of suspected child pornography or online exploitation of children across the state. What we talk about when we talk about child pornography and the concern that we have with it is that when an image is shared and somebody uses that for sexual gratification, that child who is victimized and then recorded and then disseminated is re-victimized every single time that image is viewed and re-disseminated across the state. And so we treat this as a very serious crime that is investigated thoroughly by our agents and task force affiliates across the state of Minnesota. We continue to see the number of tips into the state of Minnesota rise year after year, and this is a problem that we take very seriously. And with that, I will let you move to your next testifiers unless there's any questions from members.
Any questions from the members? Okay. Caroline Palmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Caroline Palmer, Public and Legal Affairs Manager from the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. I will just be brief as well. And just wanted to be here to express our support and to thank Representative Grassl for all of his efforts on these issues. I really think that the testimony that you heard from the survivor and her family pretty much said it all from what we would tell you. And so I want to thank them for coming forward and sharing their story. We recognize the challenges that exist with our state laws and how federal law sometimes has to come in and take care of matters. So we appreciate all of your attention to this issue. We also want to make sure that this committee, and I know we'll think about this, is where we can also make sure that we're providing appropriate and good treatment opportunities for offenders as we're looking at the penalties in the system, too. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Ryan Elson? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Ryan Else, E-L-S-E, and I'm with the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I'm not here to advocate on behalf of sex offenders. I'm here to advocate on behalf of the discretion of court professionals in the criminal justice system. Judges, prosecutors, and defense attorneys are in a much better position to judge case-by-case basis what the appropriate sentence is for a person. And we should leave that discretion open to them. For example, with the conditional release period, giving them the tool of up to 25 years would be much preferable to a mandatory 25 years. And a mandatory minimum jail sentence takes away discretion from judges that get to see these cases, get to know who the offender is, and can make a decision based on the circumstances of the offense. And since I know we're tight on time, I'll keep it at that. But thank you.
Any questions from members? Anyone from the audience wish to testify on this bill?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Teresa Paulson. I'm an attorney with Civil Society. Civil Society is a nonprofit organization out of St. Paul, Minnesota, that represents victims of sexual assault, child pornography, and human trafficking in civil proceedings with navigating the governmental resources available. Civil Society supports a mandatory minimum sentence. In this matter, the mandatory minimum is 6 months for a first-time offense. At this point, an offender must have 12 prior criminal points. Under the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines, a criminal point, if you're only using misdemeanors, it takes 3 misdemeanors to get 1 criminal point. I believe it takes, and I'm missing a couple of them in the back of my head for the gross misdemeanors and felonies, but typically speaking, people who are being caught with child pornography are going under the radar. It is not unusual for the what happened in Bemidji. It's not unusual. This legislature, the legislature a couple years ago, went through the process of enacting the solicitation of minors using electronic communications statutes for the purposes of addressing how grooming is going under the radar. And child pornography is another element of that grooming. It is part of the process that sexual predators use on children to get them to lower their inhibitions for sexual conduct. That's the point of grooming. A mandatory minimum sentence is required when courts and the Sentencing Commission are not putting in the thoughtfulness towards the age of the victim. Under the current guidelines, a prosecutor must argue upward for any prison time to be served or any jail time in the local workhouse facility. Two of the factors that a prosecutor must prove to the judge is that the particular vulnerability of the victim and the egregiousness of the offense. In child pornography, it is the exception when an offense is not egregious. It is the exception when a victim is not particularly vulnerable, because by its very act, the way that child pornography is created, it is to create an egregious act against a particularly vulnerable child. And so when our mandatory minimums do not reflect the vulnerability of the victims and the egregiousness of the offense that other people then acquire with no regard for the harm that that child went through in the creation of the image, we're not meeting our societal standard. This is about community justice. It's about our children in our community, children who will become adults and hopefully great members of our society. And acknowledging when an egregious harm has been committed against them, and making sure that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission and judges are holding offenders responsible for at least 6 months. And I'll yield for questions if anyone wants.
Any questions? Any discussion? Representative Hilston.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, this is not a new issue here. A few years ago, and maybe even last year, we've heard bills, and I've carried bills, changing the definition of child pornography. We still don't have it quite right. And so while this does speak to one piece, I wanted to validate the testimony that came from the mother who testified. The interpretation is that mere nakedness is not child pornography, and so if someone takes pictures of children, for example, in a locker room, and the children are naked, even if they weren't, if they didn't know the pictures were being taken of them, a judge has actually ruled here in Minnesota that that is not possession of child pornography. And so we have a lot of work to do with this statute, and I'll leave it at that.
And with that, we'll leave this bill over for possible inquiry.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Grassley, which one would you prefer, 2809 or 6 or?
House will move to lay over 2906 for positive inclusion.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Again, this is a bill, this is a portion of the bill that you heard last session. It is dealing with the stages of adjudication issue that keeps rearing its ugly head in our communities. This bill, with the help and meeting the concerns and the issues that the stakeholders had with it, we worked together. We put together something that is workable with most of the stakeholders, but there are still a few that are holding out. And like I said from the beginning, I've been open to working with as many people as I need to have a good working bill and statute. So with that being said, I'm going to go ahead with what I've got here right now. This bill of predatory offending registration for persons who receive stays of adjudication for sex offenses. The bill also requires the stays of adjudication sex offenses be justified in writing by the court and available to the public available to the public via the internet. Now, Mr. Chair, currently the information on state of adjudication from a civilian point of view, it cannot be followed. Representative Hilstrom and I were doing some research, and she's been helping me with this bill, that she can find the information as a former attorney, and those are pretty much the people that can track this stuff down with relative ease. But as far as the population at hand, they're still flying under the radar. And that is something that in recent years,
that has come to light through reports, that has come to light through officers reporting to me, even before I was sworn in to my office here. And it is something that we need to address, I believe. The state of adjudication, as you all know, and I'll be brief, state of adjudication, the person gets this deal when the prosecution does not quite have a strong enough case to prosecute, but the defense sees it as there's enough here that if I fight this, if I take this to trial, I may lose. So they admit to having committed that crime. And these people, with other bills along with this one, I've been trying to make sure that these people are illuminated so that the public can know, so that the public can find this information if they're searching for it, so that these individuals who have committed predatory offender type crimes won't be driving school buses. They won't be camp counselors. They won't be able to be landlords, etc. Down the line. I know there's some issue with the bill as it is still written, but meeting as many of the concerns as possible and still making sure that this is a strong bill is what I've been trying to do. So with that being said, if there are questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to make a quick statement about that. Representative Grossel did come to me to work on this issue. I understand the issue that the county attorneys have with the bill, and I have been doing my best to help him navigate a way to get something that both does away with secret sex offenders but deals with the issues that the county attorneys are concerned about. So, Mr. Chair, I'm hoping that you'll lay this over and that we can spend for possible inclusion, we can spend some time between now and when the omnibus bill is done trying to get that language right, Mr. Chair, because I think Representative Grossel is open to making some changes, and I think the county attorneys don't oppose making this information public. So if we can figure out how to do that in a way that makes everybody happy, I think it's doable.
I would appreciate that.
Caroline Palmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Caroline Palmer, Public and Legal Affairs Manager from the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and I am here to support this bill, and I also want to give our great thanks to Representative Grossel. Like, he's been working with the county attorneys and other stakeholders. He's been working very diligently with us at MnCASA, and we really appreciate all of the efforts that have come from our conversations and are pleased to be here and support the bill in its form. We definitely know that there are sometimes some occasions when stays of adjudication are necessary, when there's a victim who's too young to testify, a victim who might be incapable of testifying. That might be an instance in which a case can go forward, and a stay might be one tool that can be used. But overall, we also definitely share the concerns about how often stays are used. We think collecting the data will be helpful. We've had many conversations in this committee and other committees about stays in the context of schools, school bus drivers, today with child pornography. And so we agree that the time has come to really take a hard look at how stays are handled in our state. And I want to thank Representative Grossel again for all of his work and to hopefully answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you. Any questions among the members? Next we have Brian Ells. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Yes. Ryan Else, ELSE, with the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Once again, my concern here is the discretion of the courts and judicial efficiency. As was pointed out correctly by Representative Grossel, stays of adjudication are used in cases where trial is undesirable. And one of the greatest things in these cases that a defendant is trying to avoid is the predatory offender registration, which is essentially a bar to employment, a bar to where they can live, and a very severe punishment. They will be forced in cases where trial is not something that is desirable for the victim or for the defendant to have the public spectacle of a trial. It is a constitutional right. It is something that can't be avoided. And we as defense attorneys have to counsel them as to what penalties they will face. And when they face this term, they'll be much more likely to push a case to trial. And for that reason, I really think this should be considered a little more deeply. I think that the ramifications we see in the justice system could be much further than what the rightful goal is of notifying the public. But I do fear that there is a risk here of really pushing cases into trial where a victim is going to have to testify and go through an experience they just do not want to go through. Or the case will have to be just flat out dismissed and then the person is not held on probation. And I'll respect the committee's time.
Thank you. Robert Spahn?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Small, and I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. And first thing I'd like to do is thank Representative Grosso for his willingness to include the County Attorneys Association in many of our continued discussions. And I hope to continue to be engaged in those discussions as well. I'm not here to speak either in favor or against the bill, but I did want to call to the committee's attention an issue. I've talked to Representative Grossel about this, and I'd like to at least make the members aware of it. For sure, the County Attorneys Association does not oppose accessibility and openness. Everything we do, as I've mentioned on prior occasions, is an open court, and to the extent that we can have accessibility to the public, the County Attorneys Association is in full agreement with that. And we're aware that as Representative Hillstrom knows, if you have a case number, any member of the public can remotely access court records. But as Representative Grossel noted as well, is that members of the public usually don't have a case number to do that. We are also aware that you can go, a member of the public can go to any one of 100 locations at various courthouses within the state and do a name search and access stays of adjudication. So that's accessible at 100 different locations. The concern that we have and the issue that we have is with separation of powers issue, with the legislature dictating to the judicial branch the how to control its records. And that's our issue, that's our concern. And I've met with members of the Supreme Court to try to urge them to change their rules, and I've been unsuccessful in that regard. So that's the only concern we had. Thank you for our time. Thank you, Representative Gross.
Thank you. And with that, the bill will be laid over. Is there any public testimony before that? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have, my name is John Brandt. I do have a handout. Can I provide that to the chair?
Pages, give it to the pages, they'll hand it out.
Mr. Chair, I'm a member of the Minnesota Association of the Treatment of Sexual Abusers. I serve on the Public Policy Committee of MNATSA and also the parent organization, the National Organization Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers. It's an organization of about 3,000 professionals who are working for the treatment and prevention of sexual abuse. For about 35 years, I have worked in Minnesota with adolescents with sexual offenses and their families, helping them to recover their lives. While these offenses are serious, recidivism is much lower than public perceptions, than public perceptions, and treatment is effective. For those reasons, the bills that we're discussing here this morning should consider that recidivism is much, much lower than what is generally perceived. Dr. Grant Dewey, who is the Director of Research for the Minnesota Department of Corrections, did a study in 2013 of men with sexual offenses coming out of prison in Minnesota. The researcher studied over 1,600 offenders coming out of prison and tracked them for several years. After 4 years, there was a 2.8% reconviction. Similar studies in other states are consistent with the findings in Minnesota. Connecticut in 2012 tracked 746 offenders for 5 years after prison and 3.6% reoffended. Dr. Carl Hansen and Dr. David Thornton. Carl Hansen is with Public Service Canada. Dr. Thornton is a researcher with the state of Wisconsin. Tracked 7,700 offenders for 20 years. What they found is that 84% who were in the low to moderate risk range reoffended at a rate of between 1 and 5%. One of the surprising outcomes of their studies was that the 16% of all of the offenders who were considered at high risk to reoffend, they determined that 1 out of 5 reoffended within 5 years. And that after 10 years, the recidivism rate dropped to 4.2%. What was surprising to these researchers is that this was the best research that we had to date to document that recidivism goes down with time, not up. And in fact, Dr. Hansen and his colleagues determined that after 15 to 20 years, recidivism drops to the rate about the same rate as the average guy on the street. So research is very strong that long periods of supervision do not make the community safer. They become more a question of public policy than public safety. 95% of sexual offenses are first-time offenders. But we are putting about 95% of our public resources into tracking known offenders, and that takes resources away from primary prevention. I'm working with young men in Minnesota who were put on the sex offender registry for offenses that occurred when they were as young as 11. They're on the registry for at least 10 years, some of them for 20 years. I work with young men who have lifetime registration before they're old enough to drive and before they graduate from high school. As some of the previous testimony indicated, we're making it almost impossible for young people to recover from offenses. And what's happening is that the public policies that have been put into place to manage adult sex offenders has been migrating into the juvenile system. The laws that we're creating make it almost impossible for them to recover, and the damage extends to their families because oftentimes they cannot go home, and families are disconnected because of the registration and residency restrictions that are cropping up across Minnesota. There's no evidence that supervision of offenders is inadequate at this point. These bills will make the public feel safer, but there's no evidence that this bill will actually make the public safer. State of adjudication is extremely important for juveniles if they're going to avoid the lifelong consequences of being on the sex offender registry. I'd like to just mention the rule of 95. 95% of sexual offenses are by first-time offenders, 95% are male, and 95% will not reoffend. 40% of child sexual abuse is at the hands of older children. And most of these young people are getting caught up in the public policies that we established for adults. I'd like to encourage the committee to consider the redemption curve in the handout that I passed out. It was prepared by Dr. Carl Hansen to show how quickly recidivism drops after the initial intervention because treatment works, and that state resources would be more adequately or appropriately directed toward primary prevention. Thank you.
Any questions or comments from the committee? Okay, with that, this one, Mr. Chair. I don't have any questions, but you know, if you should like these bills then, because one, there's verbiage in it that will, unless the offender is a juvenile and the court finds the record that there's cause to waive registration requirement. Juveniles can be waived as far as having to register for unreasonable time or registering at all. The other bill, the one that we'll address here shortly, that takes into consideration and it leaves windows at 10 years where they can appeal to be off of probation. So I really don't have any. I really don't have anything else to say other than saying somebody is a first-time offender in a criminal sexual conduct case. That I really take that to heart because that is a heinous crime. That's a person crime against another, against a child, woman, whoever. And to have it just flippantly said, first-time offender. Most of them, it's the first time they've been caught. And the information that they have in a lot of these studies, I've got two studies with me right now that was provided by, I was directed to by the Minnesota BCA, shows that after treatment, the percentages increased greatly as far as known victims at time of sentencing. And then after treatment, the percentage rose probably 20-30%. What this bill does is it holds people accountable. Even if they're first-time offenders, there's a request in there for they keep the tools. I want the county attorneys to have every tool possible. But these individuals who have admitted to sexually assaulting someone, we need more accountability. And that's what this bill does. The county attorneys have the discretion, judges have the discretion, but the victims need some representation as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And with that, the bill will be laid over.
We will be in recess till 8 o'clock, or they call the chair. Room 10? We have two to go.
I'll keep going if you want to keep going.
Okay. So, that decides to do another one. So, which one would you prefer?
Mr. Chair, I prefer to do them both because it's my understanding that there are other committees that are meeting tonight as well. And so, my folks are with the governor's staff right now, but they'll be back. And so, if you want to keep going, I'm happy to keep going, Mr. Chair.
Which one do you prefer?
Which one is like this?
Short and 44.
Since we're on the criminal sexual conduct and child pornography,
these done first. Okay, we're back in and we're going to move the Little River House file 2944 for possible inclusion. And I believe we have the A1 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And can you just...
If you look at the A1 amendment,
it goes from 50 to 25 years?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Go ahead with your presentation.
It'll be short, Mr. Chair. The bill requires sex offenders to serve either a 25-year conditional release or probation terms, and imposes intensive supervision on certain sex offenders. We've made a lot of headway as far as the sentencing and the probation, the after incarceration time. I believe I've got all the stakeholders on board now for that. The
Even the County's Attorneys Association, they said they would neither stand against it or support it.
They're neutral.
Yeah, they're neutral. Which, as far as I'm concerned, that's making some headway. So, with that being said, there were some changes that we made as far as putting a window at 10 years during the probation that the offender can appeal to be released from any further. So it speaks right to the defense attorneys and the last gentleman I was up here that if there's signs of a person being turned around and headed in the right direction, and then they can appeal this process and be released from probation. So with that being said, I'll take any questions if there are any.
Ryan Elsie.
Chair and committee members, I'm Ryan Else with the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I wanted to just speak briefly on the requirements of the intensive probation on page 6 of the bill. Starting at 6.21, there's a requirement that even while in treatment, the offender must work 40 hours a week. In our experience with our clients, that would simply be impossible while they're doing the intensive sex offender treatment. We just wanted to bring that to the committee's attention.
Thank you. Ryan Erdman.
Mr. Chair, members, Ryan Erdman, I'm the director of the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections at Counties. We are the folks that do probation and supervised release for roughly 75% of the offenders in the state of Minnesota. Just want to make a couple quick comments, and I will be very brief. We are concerned about the costs. I understand there's a fiscal note, and I had a great conversation with Representative Grasso yesterday about the need to have those costs covered, because as this population grows, particularly on the intensive side, we'll see substantial costs that will be primarily borne by counties across Minnesota if the state doesn't fund it. The secondary comment I would make related to that, I guess to 25 years, I do appreciate the amendment that brought from 25 to 50 as well as the changes that allow for those opportunities to be off probation sooner than 25 years. We see as probation professionals sort of a diminishing returns, a declining amount of recidivism reduction as time goes on. Eventually that curve levels out, and the point at which that levels out is well before 25 years, quite frankly. So continued supervision after the point currently, if you need felony probation for a sex offense, on average across the state is about 160 months, which if my math is right is a little over 13 years. Continued supervision after that point is a diminishing returns sort of scenario. So we are concerned about that, even if folks are having the opportunity to be off after 10. And also that's simply not going to be reflected in the fiscal note because they're currently getting 13 years because we currently have 10 years of conditional release. The point at which our caseloads start to build because of this added supervision is like 5 biennia in the future. We're counting on that legislature 10 years from now to come back and add the resources to cover our growing caseloads. And it's not something you're not able to do now because of how that caseload builds. So that does create a concern for us, and I'm not really quite sure how we address that. But it is something that we see as a potential pitfall with the legislation. So, again, a great conversation with the representative yesterday, and with the tentative to our costs is very appreciated. So wanted to make sure to have those comments on the record. I'll take any questions, but that's all I have for you today.
Any comments from the audience?
And Mr. Chair, with our state leaning more away from incarceration and leaning more to supervision, somebody's got to pick up the ball somewhere and keep an eye on these offenders. And as I said, we've been working together to try to make sure we address the majority of the issues, and I believe we've done a good job at that.
Okay. The bill will be laid over.
I think
you want to speak again? There's going to be pretty much the same thing that you just said.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just wanted to respond generally to Representative Grasso's comments.
and to reiterate the concern that we have and that we all share, that sexual abuse is a serious public health concern, and that testimony that I provided to the committee here today was intended to draw attention to the fact that treatment is very effective and that recidivism is much, much lower than we think, and that long periods of supervision after people have completed a prison term and have completed treatment generally has, as previous gentlemen spoke to, has diminishing returns. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask you one quick question. So one of the challenges that this legislature has been attempting to deal with is folks want to get away from civil commitment and want to keep people in the criminal side instead of having to rely on civil commitment. So at some point it would be helpful if we could have a conversation about where it is that you think we could make changes that might diminish the folks that end up getting civilly committed instead of, you know, keep them on the criminal side instead of ending up with a very expensive civil commitment bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative, Manatsa would be glad to participate in those discussions. And while I can't offer up Dr. Grant Dewey, I know that his research would really help the committee develop more effective public policies.
Thank you.
The bill is laid over. 2809, and hopefully you can do that in 5 minutes.
I'll do my best, Mr. Chair.
I'll chair move 2809 for possible inclusion.
2089, this bill updates laws related to emergencies and disasters affecting state government and requires all three branches of government to coordinate and develop individualized emergency operations and continuity plans for use in event of an emergency or disaster. In a nutshell, Mr. Chair, this is to make sure that all branches of our state government are on the same sheet of music. Should a disaster or emergency happen where we cannot conduct business at the Capitol site, they're to have a plan in place. I believe at this point the executive branch is the only one that has a plan in place to relocate to another area where we can conduct state business, keep the state government, the continuity of the state government operations moving. So that the bill is just requires them to find a location, make sure that they have communications, and make sure that they have transportation to that area.
I want to thank you especially for bringing this forward. As we found out last biennium with the construction of the Capitol, we had to have the session meeting in St. Paul by statute. This was, with this, hopefully we can come up with an opportunity in case there is an emergency and we cannot meet in St. Paul, that we can actually meet. So, and with that, the bill will be laid over. And with that, we are adjourned. That works for me.